Good morning and welcome to the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. This morning we are delighted to have as our guest Dr. William Bass, the founder of the world-famous Body Farm at the University of Tennessee, or as we prefer to call it scientifically, the Anthropology Research Facility. Good morning, Dr. Bass.
Frank, how are you this morning?
I'm very well, thanks. Now, you've got a new book that is a fictional account of your life at the Body Farm called Carved in Bone that you've written with co-author John Jefferson. How does the character in Carved in Bone differ from the real life Dr. Bass?
Well, the character, my character in Carved in Bone is a forensic anthropologist named Bill Brockton, which is not too far from Bill Bass.
Yeah.
But Bill Brockton does things that Bill Bass wouldn't do.
Hey, is he your same age, or is he a little younger version of yourself?
Well, I think he's a little younger version of...
Because he's running around at crime scenes and finds himself in some danger at certain points in the book.
That's true.
So that you're saying that has not happened to you?
Well, not in the cave situation like it is in Carved in Bone, but I've had three or four cases in which the police went heavily armed. Fortunately, nothing happened, but the potential was there.
Now, for those who are just hearing about the Body Farm for the first time, it's unlikely because you've become an East Tennessee institution. Take us back, you know, to the origins of why right here, right along some of the most expensive real estate in Knox County, you've got a plot of donated corpses just doing what nature does.
Okay, well, I've got to go back a little before that. I taught for 11 years at the University of Kansas in Lawrence from 1960 to 71. I came here June the 1st of 71 and knew the medical examiner. The medical examiner at that time was a man named Jerry Francisco, who was a forensic pathologist over in Memphis. And I'd done research with Jerry, and Jerry asked if I would serve as a forensic anthropologist for the medical examiner system, and I said yes. He notifies then the 95 medical examiners in the 95 counties in Tennessee that they had somebody to identify dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And bodies started coming in. Now, essentially, half of the first 10 cases that came in were maggot-covered bodies. Now, police don't ask you who is that. They ask you how long have they been there.
Right.
And I think the reason for that is that they're trained the sooner you get on the chase, the more likely you are to solve the crime. And I didn't know anything about maggots. The material I'd gotten in Kansas were all skeletal remains. And so I looked in the literature, and there really wasn't very much in the literature.
Why is it that you had skeletons in Kansas, but not in Tennessee?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that, really, but I think...
I mean, we're talking corpses that are the same age, were skeletonized in Kansas versus Tennessee?
That's right. In Kansas, you have twice the amount of land and half as many people.
Mm-hmm.
As you do in Tennessee. Tennessee, you have half the amount of land and twice as many people. So I think that in Tennessee, the possibility of being found in an active decay stage where there's a smell is much greater than
okay.
It is in Kansas.
So the bodies are found earlier.
That's right. In western Kansas, with those large ranches and things like that, you know, you died on one of the ranches and you're found a year or 5 or 10 years later as a skeleton.
The maggots are already done with the body by the time you found them in Kansas.
That's right. Maggots are really active about, let's be generous here, the first month.
I was wondering if it was a climate thing, if the climate in Kansas was that different than here.
Well, it's certainly hotter. And it's colder in the winter and hotter in the summer.
Mm-hmm. When we drove through Kansas moving to Tennessee, my wife hated it. I made her stop at this place, and it was all dust and heat, and
yes.
And you know, they happened to have livestock there, and it just the smell of it.
That's true. If you've ever, of course, I lived there 11 years, but mm-hmm. You'd go on a picnic, and you'd have your sandwich made, and you'd stop at a roadside rest area out in western Kansas with the wind blowing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the humidity is 2% or something like that. Before you got done eating your sandwich, it was like a piece of dry bread. I mean, it just
desiccated.
Desiccated. It just sucked all the water right out of that.
So the same thing would happen. The same thing would happen
to the
body. Unfortunate
right.
body
yeah.
who would you know yeah. passed away. Okay, so the climate in Tennessee being
it's more
more humid.
It's more much more humid, and not the extremes that you get in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then you have the world-famous Body Farm. I mean, I guess we'll get around, keep get back to the origins of it for a second. But here, the bodies that you study, the decomposition you study, really is unique to this area. You can't necessarily use the same information here as you would, let's say, in Las Vegas, home of CSI on television.
That's correct.
So why don't they have body farms in every climate? Why isn't there one in every city in America?
Frank, that's a great question. And I have tried my career to get other people to start one of these, particularly with my colleagues in the forensic anthropology area.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my first student from the University of Kansas taught at the University of Arizona in Tucson for years and years. This is Dr. Walter Berkby. And Walt retired and works for the medical examiners there.
Wait a second. You've got students who are retired? And you're not retired?
Well, officially I am retired,
okay.
but I'm doing all these other things. Well, yeah, I have probably three or four students who have retired now.
Okay.
Walt Berkby at Arizona and Ted Rathman at South Carolina. And I'd have to think some, but
okay.
Yeah.
So you tried to get him to start a body farm.
I tried to get him to start one because, you see, Arizona's low desert, and it's much different from what you have here. I have a colleague who retired at the University of New Mexico, Stan Ryan, and that's high desert.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things differ. There is one body farm that has just gotten started now besides the one here, and this is over at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee.
And how does that help?
Well, okay, exactly.
It's the same climate, isn't it?
Okay. John Williams, who is the anthropologist over there, taught for 20 years at the University of North Dakota in Fargo. Well, 20 years of Fargo winners. I mean, mm-hmm. He had a chance to leave. He left. Unfortunately, it was at Cullowhee. And, it's the same climatic condition. It's just on the east side of the mountains instead of the west side.
All right. So maybe you get a different sparrow or something.
That's right.
One unique woolly worm that's different over there.
Well, he started last year, and they had, you know, some of the hurricanes last year. He had three bodies out on the hillside, and the floods came and washed the three bodies out in the valley, and he had all kinds of news coverage that wasn't very good. He's having his problems getting started.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Bass, the founder of The Body Farm at the University of Tennessee and co-author of the new book Carved in Bone, which is a novel, and the previous nonfiction book Death's Acre, which you co-wrote with John Jefferson both. Take us back again through the history of The Body Farm. You talked about how you were in Kansas. You'd find bodies there that were bone. Here in Tennessee, they'd be covered with insects or found more recently. But that kind of led you to realize that there was more research to be done.
Well, as I said, that there was very little in the literature about maggots and what they do to reduce a corpse. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to be talking to police about this, I need to know what I'm talking about. So in November of 71, I went to the dean of the college at UT and said, "Dean, I need some land to put dead bodies on." And he looked up the people over in the ag campus that control land. And we started off with a sow barn up at the Holston Farm, which is the farm where the Holston and the French Broad River come together to make the Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's where the Three Rivers Rambler goes when you take the train ride.
Exactly.
Up there.
Okay.
I know exactly the trestle you're talking about. From there, you can see all
those
three.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's a nice view there.
Mm-hmm.
We began. Now, let me go back and add a little bit more. I came to Tennessee to build a graduate program in anthropology. They have an undergraduate program only, and it takes a while to build a graduate program. You've got to get graduate students who can do the research and so forth. So the major research in the King bodies really didn't start till the late 70s and the early 80s. And that's where Death's Acre, the book, starts in 1980 with the founding of the area back at the University of Tennessee Hospital.
Right. And what was the reaction of the dean or the president of the university when you said to him, "I would like to leave regular people on the ground to decay"?
Nothing but support. Everybody asked that. And I think the reason that other universities don't do it is because of the complaints they feel they're going to get.
Well, when your body farm started, it can't be that well received.
Nobody complained.
Really?
It really wasn't until 1981. See, it had been in existence 10 years.
Before anybody found out.
Before anybody found out about it. So,
well, I've seen pictures of in Death's Acre of protesters outside of the body farm. That was 10 years after.
That was 10 years after it started, yes. Now, it was when we moved over to the area back at the University of Tennessee Hospital, and the hospital decided to build a parking lot. So they built parking lots on three sides of the body farm. Now, they couldn't move me because I was grandfathered in.
But it made it nice for you. You'd have a short walk from the parking lot to the research facility.
One of the people, one of the guys driving one of the scrapers to make the parking lot was the son of the president of what's called SICK. That's Solutions of Issues of Concern to Knoxvillians. Mm-hmm. And they thought this was something that they ought to picket about. And so I thought it was kind of funny. They had this great big sign, "This makes me sick." There's a picture of that in Des Acre. But we're not doing anything illegal or immoral.
Right.
And they said, well, they just want us to move to Oak Ridge. Go over there behind the fences. The university came to my help. I mean, Jack Reese, who was the chancellor at that time, who died just recently, Jack paid to have a chain link fence put around the body farm.
Okay. Yeah. Now, a chain link fence wouldn't really keep out nosy sightseers who are parked too close.
No.
Now, you have another benefactor who helped you.
Then the UT hospital came along and put a modesty fence on the inside. But I make a good neighbor for the hospital because nobody wants to park over by the body farm because in the summer you can smell it. And so the hospitals never complain because I get their employees there a half an hour before they're supposed to be.
One of my favorite parts about the new novel Carved in Bone, written by Dr. Bass, is when you describe the most expensive real estate in Knoxville up on
Cherokee Bluff.
And you say how these houses, when the wind is right, they're getting the cows from the ag campus and the corpses from the body farm all the odors are all going right up to the nice homes there in Sequoia Hills.
The medical examiner lives up in the condominiums on top of Cherokee Bluff, and I see her down the morgue occasionally, and she say, "I smelled you this morning." But that only occurs in the summer when
what happened when the body farm became the body farm? I mean, it was the anthropology research facility for all those years, and then at some point, Patricia Cornwell gets involved. How did that happen?
Okay, I've known Patricia Cornwell for many years. In fact, I knew her before she was a writer. I have lectured for many years to the forensic pathologists around the world and have lectured on a fairly regular basis for the medical examiner in Virginia.
By any chance, does she inspire one of the characters in your novel?
Exactly.
Because there's one of them, just as I'm reading, I'm thinking, that could be
Kay Scarpetta, who is Patricia Cornwell's major character, is based upon Marcel Fierro, who is the medical examiner in Virginia.
Okay.
And I've lectured for Marcel Fierro for many years. And so when Trisha Cornwell has in the body farm, she has a case of a teenager who was killed in a basement and then moved out to a lakeshore. And she wondered how police would know this. So Art Bohannon and I did a research project.
Bohannon of the Knoxville Police Department.
Of the Knoxville Police Department. And I did a research project. He is Dr. Katz in her book, and I'm Dr. Lyle Shade in that book.
Now, I've read, that's the first of her novels that I read, and I went and have read the whole series since then. In that case, if I remember correctly, you took a coin, the character based on you, took a coin and placed a corpse on top of it to see if it would make an impression. Did you actually make that same experiment?
Exactly. That was only one of about 15 things that we used. We had all kinds of things under the body. It's interesting that the concrete slab we put the body on had a crack in it. Mm-hmm. And as the body settles down and the tissue forms that crack. So we put quarters. There's a beautiful, I mean, you really could see, you could tell it was a quarter and read the letters on the quarter on the body when we.
So the impression of the quarter made into the skin as the body decomposed.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
When someone donates their body to the body farm, do they know that that's where they're going to, or have they just donated their body to science in general, and they don't really care what happens to it after that?
Well, all of the above. Let me say that we get bodies from three sources. We get unclaimed bodies that come through the medical examiner system. These may be identified or unidentified.
Mm-hmm.
We have the husband and wife that decide, you know, when I die, I want my body donated to science, but they never do anything. They
don't fill out the forms.
They don't
or
fill
whatever.
Out a form or anything like that. So when one of them dies, the mortician will come. The surviving spouse will say they always want their body donated to science. So the mortician will call and say, do you want a body?
The forms, by the way, are available on the internet now at the UT website.
We've gone to that because now
there's a link from deathsacre.com that'll take you right there.
That's good. I see you've been using our website. I've been on TV enough that we have over 700 people who have willed their bodies to the anthropology department. Literally what they're doing is willing their skeleton to the anthropology department. Now, they sign a statement that their bodies can be used for research, but we don't say necessarily what research, because the research that goes on in the body farm are master's thesis and doctoral dissertations. So, you know, they can be whatever.
These are going to be new ideas that the students of tomorrow are coming up with all the time. Okay.
And we're getting more and more specific, looking at changes in the body.
Give me two examples from the past of a type of research project that a student came up with.
Okay.
I know there's one involving a barbecue grill.
Okay. Let me say that what we did to start with, we established what happens in decay.
Okay.
And we established that there are four stages. There is fresh, bloat, decay, and dry. Now, that is the same all over the world, except that it is faster in Florida because it's warmer, mm-hmm. and slower in Wisconsin because it is colder.
Same fastest, reason that bodies are kept in the fridge at the funeral home and at the morgue.
That's right.
Yeah.
So your sequence is the same. Your climatic conditions and your temperature mainly are what change that.
Fresh, bloat.
Fresh, bloat, decay, and then dry.
Dry, okay.
Okay. Now, that sequence is used all over. So going back to one of your questions you asked earlier, if you are a forensic anthropologist in Florida, then you can take that same sequence that we've done, but you need to speed it up because of the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
We use what are called, in the science of it now, we use what are called accumulated degree days.
Yes.
So that what you do, if body X has been missing 20 days, okay, you want to get the mean temperature for every one of those 20 days. And the mean temperature, we can predict what that body is going to look like, how much decay, what that decay is going to be, whether there are going to be maggots on the body.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this then gets more complicated because then you have to ask a question, was the body in the sun or the shade? If in the sun, it's going to decay faster than in the shade because it's going to be warmer.
Right.
Is it clothing or no clothing? Is it inside or a structure or outside? Can the flies get to it and lay their eggs for maggots? So this is where you get all the specifics coming in. Now, the specifics that some of the students have done, one that I think we've quoted maybe in the book, in Carved in Bone, how much weight does a decaying body lose in one day?
Oh, I know.
Okay. Okay. Well, we found that one day, one cadaver lost 40 pounds.
Amazing.
So it is amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see that the maggots are really doing what nature wanted them to do. They're reducing a corpse to its lowest common denominator, which are bones and teeth.
The book Blowfly by Patricia Cornwell also comes back to Knoxville for a body farm reference.
That's right.
And which I think, if I'm not mistaken, they took some blowflies and painted them UT orange released them at you. In fact, that book. You weren't Lyle Shade anymore. You were back to being Bill Bass in that book.
Okay.
Is that right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And released them at Neyland Stadium. And what happened?
Well, Bill Rodriguez, who was one of my graduate students at that time, who is now the forensic anthropologist for the National Medical Examiner System, Bill and I went over and we captured five flies. Now, when you capture, you have the nets. We netted five flies.
At the body farm?
At the body farm.
Because there'd be plenty.
Took them back over to the football stadium. My office is in Neyland Stadium. And we put a little orange dot on them, a recognition orange. In Tennessee, what other color would you use?
So this is real. When I read this in a novel by Cornwell, this actually happened. Okay.
We took them outside of the office and they listened and we let them go. The next day, three of those flies were on bodies at the body farm. And this is as the flywood flies about a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
So they crossed the Tennessee River and went back to the body farm. I asked the students, just joking, I said, do you know where the other two were? I didn't know where. I said, it was over at food service. And the students said, We don't know where the other two went.
But those are the flies whose eggs become the maggots that eat the corpse.
That's right. The blowflies are the green and blue iridescent flies. They're not house flies.
They call them blue bottles in England, I think.
Okay, blue bottles. Blue bottles.
The reason I ask is I was reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and they're talking about a dead blue bottle on the windowsill. I had no idea what it is.
Okay.
I looked it up, and it was a blowfly.
Yeah. They're green and blue. They're iridescent. And they are, people ask, how long does it take to get there? Well, many times, Frank, I've taken bodies out in the back of the truck, mm-hmm. and we get the body from the truck onto the ground, which maybe takes 10, 15 seconds.
Right.
And there's a blowfly on the body.
So that quickly.
That quickly. They are zeroed in. When an animal, fish, or bird dies, there's a breakdown of the tissue. The enzymes begin to break down the cells, and this gives off a smell, and they have an intense smell that they can pick these things up for literally miles away.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Bass, author of Carved in Bone, co-author with John Jefferson, and of course the book Death's Acre, based on his research at the Anthropology Research Facility at the University of Tennessee. We know it as the Body Farm. It's become a beloved part of East Tennessee. How is that possible? I mean, I'm a fan of it. I'm not the only one. There's people who've been to your book signings. People go to your lectures, and they're just lined up to see what is it that's fascinating is about death to the living.
I'm not sure I know the real answer to that. I've thought a lot about it, and I think, you know, we're not a culture of death. Somebody is killed out on interstate. The police come. They hold up a sheet so you can't see.
Right.
In the news business or the TV people come. They won't let you take a picture of it.
People used to die at home, and now they die in a sterile environment somewhere else away, into the
That's
hospital.
Right.
Or.
And what you do then is you put it in a van, and you take it to the morgue. You don't go to the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
They do their work at the morgue, and then they'll go to the funeral home. And if you see that individual again, it would be at an open coffin.
Right, with makeup and embalming fluid.
And then you're buried. And so I think there's this whole area from death from the time you're dead, all those steps it takes to get you into the coffin and buried. People are interested in what happens. And our culture doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. So I think this is why they're interested in what I do and how I make these decisions and so forth.
Now, your goal at the Body Farm, if you will, is not only to study the decomposition of the flesh, but also to reduce the body down to a skeleton. Talk about how the skeletons of 2006 are different from the skeletons that you might have studied when you went to school, you know, back in the 1900s.
Okay. Well, you're not far off.
Well, by meaning anywhere. Right. I don't know what year you went to school.
I was going to the three major skeletal collections. They are called cadaver collections. I was studying these in the 1950s as a graduate student.
Which isn't that long ago. I mean, you know,
55 years ago. Yeah,
but I mean, that's still within many of our lifetimes and certainly our parents' lifetimes.
Yes, okay. Beginning at about 1900, up from 1900 to about 1950, there were anatomists in three medical schools in the United States that decided that they wanted to keep the skeleton so they could use this as research to see, you know, to determine age and sex and race and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of these was at Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. One was at St. Louis, and one was at Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
The problem with these are that individuals in a cadaver collection, now this means that when you die, your body is given to the medical school to be a cadaver and for medical students to dissect.
All right.
The major problem with the cadaver collections are that they're older individuals. Let's say, for example, that you when you were 80 and you died in 1920, that you ended up in a cadaver collection.
Okay.
We're studying you. Okay. That individual, however, was born in 1840, you see. It was born 20 years before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you are studying skeletal remains in humans, that area of research is called secular change. And we know that bodies change through time. And there have been tremendous changes since the 40s.
So you our skeletons today are different from our grandparents' and our great-grandparents' skeletons.
Exactly. Let me give an example that get your listeners would know. If you go to England and you look at the suits of armor that the knights used, they're little short guys. I mean, you know, if they're 5'2" or 5'3", they were big individuals. Mm-hmm. We now are 6 feet.
Well, that's true. Yeah, we were talking about George Washington being a giant, and they say 6 feet tall. He was so tall. Well, so what?
Well, I mean, he would fit right in with the population. Nobody would know much difference now.
Right.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was considered unusually tall back then, and now...
Exactly.
Well, so the bones are that much different? I mean, when you're studying, you could tell a recent skeleton from one that's 100 years old just by looking at them.
Yes.
What would be the first thing you look for?
From the
height?
Measurement. Okay. not only the skeleton, but... Let's take individual bones. Let's take the skull, for example, which is the bone that comes in the most often in a forensic setting.
Mm-hmm.
The skulls are higher than they were, say, 100 years ago. Now, why is our skull getting larger? I don't know. I mean, we haven't figured that out.
More brain power?
Well, it doesn't seem to be. I mean, if we... or have more brain power, we don't seem to be using it for anything.
Well, you know, speaking of not using brain power, your book Carved in Bone takes place in fictional Cook County, where there's a lot of things that looked pretty familiar there to me. You had cockfighting, you had marijuana farms, you had homes hidden behind kudzu to escape notice from the authorities. How much of that really takes place in East Tennessee? I mean, what kind of research did you and John Jefferson do for that?
Well, the county is really Cook County,
mm-hmm.
which we call Cook County.
So there's not a little bit of Greene County mixed in? I thought maybe there was.
There could be,
okay.
Because it's in that general geographical area where you have mountains and valleys.
Well, they just had a big, huge pot bust in Greene County that sounded like it came right out of your book.
Well, Carbon
Bone. A dairy farm,
that's right.
Which was really a marijuana farm.
That's right. Reading the book now. It's just like reading the newspaper.
Yeah.
But this was written a year before.
Wow.
Actually, John went to a cockfight. So the cockfight in Death in Carved in Bone is John's description of the cockfight in Del Rio.
And it's one of my favorite scenes in the book when your character, Dr. Bill Brockton, let's just say he is overwhelmed by everything or the surroundings.
That's right. Okay.
You know, there's several things. I don't want to give away the book because it's a terrific read, but there's several things that happened to him at the cockfight to the point where he becomes ill.
That's right.
Was that based on John's experience?
It's based on John's experience. That's right.
So did he throw up?
He threw up. He sure did.
Because that's what, as you read this, you know, it takes place in Knoxville. You describe beautifully, as I mentioned before, the Sequoia Hills being covered with the scent of decomposition. You can picture the drive from the campus, getting onto I-40 and going all the way out. That's how you know it's Cook County, because, you know, he even barely changed the name of Newport to something else port. I have to look it up to tell you.
We describe the courthouse. I mean, it's very, you could, if you look at the courthouse and read it, you can see that's a description of the courthouse in Newport. That's right.
But is that something like Patricia Cornwell will tell you to say, well, you want to change it a little bit, or how do you decide what to keep and what to change?
The story was John. So John decided that what the story would be, and I'm the one that supplied the science for the bodies that John has in his stories.
Mm-hmm.
But John's good at description. I mean, that's a really good description of the terrain and the mountains and so forth. Yeah.
Well, the book is Carved in Bone by Dr. William Bass, Bill Bass, and John Jefferson, using the pen name Jefferson Bass together.
Right.
I just looked at the clock and realized that we have been talking for half an hour already, and it feels like we've been gone for 5 minutes. So I'm going to have to wrap it up on the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. Dr. Bass, any final comments before we sign off? And I hope you can come back and we can do this again sometime, because I enjoy speaking with you so much.
Thank you, Frank, for letting me be on your program. And anytime I can help you, let me know. I'd be happy to do it.
Oh, that's fantastic. The book, again, Carved in Bone, it's available at bookstores everywhere. Keep your eyes out and check the website, jeffersonbass.com and deathsacre.com for information on how you can donate your body to the Body Farm, or just find out there's a video tour you could take and satisfy your curiosity. And we didn't even get into the part about how Patricia Cornwell bought you the privacy fence and all that other interesting stuff. All right. Dr. Bass, again, thank you. Join us again next week at this same time on the East Tennessee Report. I'm Frank Murphy. Good morning.